unemployment hits 4% for the first time in a couple years, Bitcoin is stuck at $70,000, and global rate cuts have begun. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. In today's global macro update, we're going to go through the US economy, spend a lot of time on the Bitcoin price, risk markets, and we'll talk about what's going on in the money markets and the Fed's balance sheet as well. Let's start with this morning's release from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. We saw the unemployment rate hit 4% for the first time since early 2022. Now, as you can see in this chart, unemployment has steadily headed higher over the last year and a half. And we see that the unemployment rate is starting to get to the point where the Fed is going to take notice. So with unemployment here at 4%, we do see that the labor market is starting to show signs of slowing. So in this next chart, I want to focus on the JOLTS data that we saw earlier in the week. Now here you see the number of job openings has fallen to about 8 million. This is down from well north of 12 million a couple years ago. So what we are seeing here, less jobs available. Now in the red and maroon lines, you can see that hires and quits have both been trending lower as well. As openings fall, we have less people that are hired, and we also have less people that are confident enough in the labor market to quit their job. Now, thanks to this zero hedge chart, we have a component of the non-farm payroll data that we can see gives it a lot of noise. So 1.5 million jobs created since May of 2023. So over the past year, 1.5 million jobs part-time, but 1.2 million full-time jobs destroyed. So in this way, a net gain, but this net gain is replacing full-time jobs with part-time jobs. So the quality of these jobs that we see added in this non-farm payroll headline number that the financial media loves, it really brings a lot of noise. That's why we are focusing on the unemployment rate. Now, in this next chart, we have here from the Financial Times the number of foreign-born and native-born workers with a large divergence. Now, this has nothing to do with the politics of immigration, but simply because we have immigrants coming into the country, we have a huge amount of jobs that are created. But again, it's based off of this statistic, which might have to do more with adjustments than it has to do with actual jobs. So that's why we're watching things like the ISM services and ISM manufacturing employment sub-indices, which we got this month, which showed really not that strong of a labor market. Those indices are in the contraction territory. The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by River. River is a Bitcoin-only exchange if you guys are looking for a place to get allocated. Go check them out today at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 in Bitcoin for free when you purchase. The most important thing about River is that River does not use a third-party custodian for Bitcoin. That means when you purchase Bitcoin on River, River has its own storage solution and is not relying on any third party to custody that Bitcoin. It also means that they have an amazing technical expertise. It's a great team over there at River. Go check them out, river.com/TBL. Okay, excellent. Let's talk about the Bitcoin price now. We are going to look at this chart here with our eyes on $80,000. Bitcoin having a very solid period here of consolidation around the $70,000 mark. So we are watching the $70,000 level, really the $70,000 to $72,000 level, because when it breaks out above 72, Bitcoin is going to be off to the races and be looking at 75 to 80 very, very quickly here. We have seen an enormous wave of demand into ETFs coming over the last few days. We're going to talk about that in a second. But first, I want to show you the last couple halvings marked here in red in vertical lines. And what we see in the purple line, this is the realized price, the on-chain cost basis of Bitcoin. It changes when the realized price changes when new capital is coming into Bitcoin. And so what we have here is there a big capital inflow happening right now into Bitcoin. The realized price is now approaching $31,000. And what that is doing to the MVRV, which is our ratio between the market price and the realized price, that is consolidating MVRV in this 2 to 2.5 range. We find this to be incredibly healthy bull market behavior. Why? The reason is we are not seeing a large divergence between the market price and the realized price. It means that the market price is being driven by real activity, not speculative activity. And so we have talked about this also recently. We are not seeing funding rates spike. Now, funding rates are the rates of leveraged Bitcoin positions in the derivatives market. So we have Bitcoin exchanges that offer futures trading. Those futures contracts have an embedded funding rate. This is the rate that we can imagine that the long position is paying to the market to engage in leverage. With funding rates muted, we know that Bitcoin's activity is really being driven by the spot market. That is confirmed by realized price marching higher day after day. So it's less speculation here and more based on data using these two metrics in tandem. We can really estimate here that Bitcoin's price is being moved by buyers in the spot market, and we know that Bitcoin ETFs are big buyers in the spot market because based off of these regulations from the SEC, we know that the Bitcoin ETFs have to and must custody Bitcoin with a regulated custodian, and that custody of Bitcoin is done via proper Bitcoin transactions, moving Bitcoin on the Bitcoin blockchain from the exchanges or whatever platform is being used to purchase Bitcoin and sending them to these digital vaults, which we know that Coinbase is one of the most prominent service providers to these Bitcoin ETFs. So as these ETFs buy Bitcoin, move it on chain, put them into digital vaults held mostly at Coinbase, Fidelity has their own service that they're providing to their own ETF with Fidelity Digital Assets, that those transactions are showing up here in the purple line. And it is keeping the green line muted. And when the green line is muted, it means that we are not in a speculative bubble phase of Bitcoin. And this is probably the most important thing for you guys at home that are Bitcoin holders. You're wondering, is Bitcoin in a hype phase, a bubble phase? And I can tell you based off of the MVRV ratio alone that Bitcoin is not in that bubble phase. We mentioned ETF inflows driving realized price higher. You can see here, this is a chart that we've borrowed from our friend Checkmate over on Check on Chain. Check has this chart showing us that the net inflow recently for Bitcoin ETFs near $1 billion on a single day. This is on par with the previous all-time high levels that we struck in February, March, when Bitcoin was having this really intense rally post-ETF approval dip, and now we are back at these levels. This is important because it tells us that the demand from institutions for Bitcoin held in digital custody in a regulated manner is very, very strong and wasn't just a blip on the radar because of a newness factor when these ETFs were approved. So again, another bullish indication from institutional demand. We are looking at the Bitcoin price and we are seeing it stuck at $70,000. So why is Bitcoin stuck at $70,000? We'll give you a macro backdrop overlay for why that might be the case, but from a pure demand perspective, on judging based on these ETF inflows and just the realized price, which doesn't include only ETF action, it includes the entire network. And so what we see here, the demand is strong, and we see that as supportive to the Bitcoin price. Now, we've talked about preparing for a six-figure Bitcoin here over the past year or so, and what we want you to look at is the long-term chart of Bitcoin on a log scale. this gives you a little bit more peace of mind that Bitcoin really is in the early stages of a multi-decade adoption trend, and it will have large pops and drawdowns on its way. But look at the two red horizontal lines I have for you at 100,000 and at $250,000. You can see here that over the next 3 to 4 years, just based off of this gentle ascent in logarithmic trend, that Bitcoin is headed to six figures. It could be headed there in a very short time horizon and then have a lot of volatility, or it could have more muted volatility and get there over a longer term time horizon. But either way, what we are seeing here is that Bitcoin is following this exponential adoption trend. That's why we have the log scale, because the log scale allows us to view exponential adoption on a scale that our brains are allowed to comprehend. And so if Bitcoin continues an exponential adoption trend, we are headed to Bitcoin prices between $100,000 and $250,000 over the next few years. So in our bullish stance, we see this timeline much more accelerated. I want you guys to prepare for six-figure Bitcoin, not by 2027, but by the end of this year. And in that way, we are much more bullish than just a long-term log scale look at the Bitcoin price. So I want to give you the extremely accelerated timeline, and that we are looking for really strong Bitcoin price action here in this current bull market, with also giving you the sense that it doesn't all have to happen right away. It can happen over the next few years. You can get to 250,000 here on Bitcoin by 2027, and it would completely fall into the context of this chart, tracking that blue line here that I have for you. Now let's talk about risk markets for a second here. I have the S&P 500 up on the screen, and it has shown really a lot of strength and an incredible run here over the past couple years, after we had really a tough time at the beginning of 2022 when Jerome Powell and the Fed were hiking rates really aggressively and getting into that really that fear zone that we are headed for 10% sustained inflation, and that 10% sustained inflation would cause the Fed to hike rates to 10%, and that would destroy the present value of equity valuations. That was the fear trade in 2022. It's faded, and it's faded hard as inflation has come back from the precipice. And also what you've had in the backdrop is you've had a couple of crises in the financial system. You had one with the Bank of England coming in to save the UK bond market, and you had the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in the United States, and the Fed come with a rescue facility called the BTFP, which added a quick couple hundred billion to the Fed's balance sheet. So liquidity conditions very supportive, even though rates have remained at north of 5%. So those conditions that have caused the stock market to have a really amazing run over the last couple years also apply to Bitcoin. So when we think about risk markets and the liquidity conditions from central banks that support risk assets, Bitcoin fits right into that. So that's why we look at stocks to see here, hey, do stock prices support higher Bitcoin prices? And right now we can confirm that, and we can say yes, that stock prices are confirming good liquidity conditions for Bitcoin. I know a lot of you in the United States are focused on the November presidential election. We also have congressional elections going on throughout the company, including a couple very important ones, notably one Senate race going on in Massachusetts, in which the American public has the opportunity to remove somebody that has had a very anti-Bitcoin and anti-free market stance, generally speaking, over the last 6 years. So I do, however, want to point out that when it comes to which party is in power at the executive branch, that we have red and blue really both driving the debt to GDP ratio higher. So I would suggest here that if we get a change from blue to red in November at the polls, that you won't necessarily see any change in the debt to GDP ratio at the United States, or you won't see any change in the overall drive of more and more deficit spending. That seems to be a bipartisan occurrence, and something that I wanted to point out for you here, that really since the 1980s, we have had a bipartisan move higher in debt to GDP. Now let's switch gears here to the US Treasury curve. This chart, this is not a time series. This is the term structure of interest rates. So on the y-axis, you have yield as usual, but on the x-axis, instead of looking at past prices through time, what we are looking at is the entire term of what the US Treasury offers in terms of debt instruments. So that's 0 to 30 years. So the 30-year part of the curve is on the right-hand side of the chart. Right now, trading at about 4.5%. The 10-year part of the curve trading closer to 4.3%. And the front end of the curve trading above 5% as policy rates are still at 5.33%. So right now, we still have an inverted yield curve from the very front end of the curve. So this is one-month bills down to the five-year part of the curve. Then it does steepen out a little bit from 5 to 20 years and then reinverts back from 20 to 30 years. So the shape of the yield curve here right now, generally speaking, is inverted, but it does have a little bit of wonkiness as we go throughout the 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 to 30 part of the curve. Now, you might be asking yourself, why are there parts of the curve that are, or you might be asking yourself here, why is the 15-year or the 25-year part of the curve filled in? I didn't think that the Treasury issued 15-year bonds and 25-year bonds. Well, you're right, it doesn't. But every bond issued as a 30-year 7 years ago today is a 23-year bond. And so in that way, we have hundreds of Treasury securities across the curve. And you see that represented here with different points of maturity. So I wanted to give you guys a sense of where the curve is. The long-term part of the Treasury curve still has rate expectations in the 4 area, 4.5. That is different than the front end of the curve, which has 5% rates, which are really pinned by policy rates, which are north of 5%. So policy rates are expected to decline over the long term based off of the current term structure of interest rates. That doesn't mean that it will happen. It just means that that is the expected path. Okay, shifting gears once again to talk about the global economy and global interest rates. Let's take a look first, before we talk about global rates, at the global economy. We're going to look at PMIs across the different regions. Europe is represented with orange bars here, North America in red, and Asia in green. And what you see is that Europe in recession, Germany, Italy, and France, all with PMIs sub 50, India and Russia, the two strongest economies in the world right now, and the US really middle of the road. Big news out of global central banks this week. We see rate cuts happening across the world, both in Canada and in Europe. I have pictured for you both of those rate cuts, and you can see here that with them happening in the same week, we remember our lessons from the BIS and what goes on in Basel. So it is our understanding that in Basel, what occurs is not necessarily the BIS people and directors telling the individual central bankers what to do and where to guide policy. No, that's not what we believe happens. Rather, we believe that the central bankers come together and decide as a group what is the best path for rates and who should go first and why it's more important for this central bank or that central bank to cut rates based off of trade or FX rates. So it is a coordination mechanism. That's what Basel is. It is a place where central bankers coordinate policy. So we see coordinated policy rates coming down. Switzerland was first, Bank of Canada was second, European Central Bank was third. Now, who will be next? We are looking at the Bank of England and the Fed to see, okay, which central bank is going to bring rates down next? But instead of asking yourself who's going to be next and when the next rate cut is going to happen from one of these large central banks, you should instead be thinking that the tides have shifted and we have gone from hikes to cuts, not on a local basis, but on a global basis and a globally coordinated basis. So now global central banks took rates up together and they will take them down together. Who is next? Is it going to be the Fed? We think that the Fed will be cutting rates based off of this globally coordinated central bank movement, but it is uncertain whether the Fed is going to cut in September, November, or next year. Now, just this morning, we were looking at Fed rates almost locked in for at least a September or November cut. Now, after the non-farm payroll numbers this morning, where the headlines were good jobs, everything is fine in the economy, no need to cut yet, a lot of that pricing in has reversed already. So yes, it is uncertain when the cut will be. What is not uncertain is the direction of policy rates looking forward. That's why I showed you the term structure of US interest rates. You can see the inversion. The inversion is for a reason. Bond traders, when they have an inverted yield curve, what they are expressing to the market is that we believe the path of policy rates will be lower. Now, they might be wrong. They might be wrong for years even, but it is their expression. Again, the term structure of interest rates, it's not a prediction. It's not what's going to happen. It's an expression of expectations from the traders themselves. Now let's close with a discussion on money markets. I want to talk about the ample reserves framework. We've done a lot of work on ample reserves lately. We did a video this week on the ample reserves framework in which a Stanford Business School professor wrote an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal and made the claim that we can use Fedwire and the timing of intraday payments to track when reserves are becoming too scarce. And he used the example of September 2019 to show how a repo crisis can happen and how the Fed can avoid that repo crisis even if it decides to go full steam on QT, which is a decrease in the size of the Fed's balance sheet and a decrease in the quantity of reserves in the system. So if you guys are interested in a full piece on the ample reserves framework, go check out our video from earlier this week. And of course, you can become a TBL Pro member at thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. And TBL Pro members have access to all of our cutting-edge research. They can also participate in our monthly live Zoom Q&A sessions. Now, in this money markets chart, I have five metrics that we track here. Of course, I had to throw in Bitcoin here as the fifth one in orange just to give you a sense of how large Bitcoin is compared to some of the other money market vehicles out there. So in the black line, we have total money market fund assets. This is the AUM of money market funds broadly. In green, you have the supply of treasury bills. Now, some of those bills are owned by money market funds. Money market funds also finance some of those bills at the dealer level through the repo market. That is represented in the purple line. So the purple line is really a blend of the green line and the black line, because the black line are the investors, the purple line are the dealers, and the green line is the Treasury Department that's issuing securities purchased by money market fund asset, money market funds, as well as banks who need money from the money market funds to finance those positions. That's the purple line. That's SOFR volume. Now, SOFR volume, again, is the total amount of Treasury securities that need financing at the dealer level on a nightly basis. So, $2 trillion means dealers have about $2 trillion in inventory, and that inventory, treasury inventory, needs to be financed every single night and mostly done so by the money market fund complex. We also see reverse repo now below $400 billion in red. Reverse repo is continuing to bleed out as money market funds find an attractive yield in bills and basically remove their reliance on the reverse repo facility, trying to lock in that higher yield via bills. Now, this next chart is a representation of ample reserves versus regional banks. So we have this because, as you see in 2023, what happened to the price of regional banks? They collapsed in a mini banking crisis. And I say mini because the Fed was able to give their bailout facility to the market, the BTFP, essentially right away, stopping the crisis in its tracks, and also extending the bailout, extending to the FDIC, who basically insured infinity deposits up from $250,000. And that insurance of deposits really shored up these banks and prevented banking runs and prevented the ample reserves framework from coming into question, because as deposits flee the system, banks need reserves to fund those deposit flights. And when deposits go away and reserves decline, that puts a stress on the system. Again, I'll point you to the video from earlier this week on a potential repo crisis and why the Fed is doing a slowdown to QT now. So regional banks, they've had a pretty okay run of it the last year since the Silicon Valley crisis and the lows there in the spring of 2023. But if reserves keep declining, what does that do to smaller banks? It puts them in jeopardy. So we're going to be watching QT, any announcements from the Fed, and we're going to be watching the path of reserves and to see here if the regional banks are going to respond in a negative way. And I should note here that the green line is the total SOMA holdings. So this is the asset portfolio of the Fed declining and pictured. But when we look at reserves also, we can see that reserves are not necessarily following the total path of the balance sheet. That is due to a couple things, notably the decline in reverse repo that has supported the quantity of reserves in the system. In our final chart, we borrowed it from Cross Border Capital founder Michael Howell. And Michael and I were having a conversation on Twitter X about these ample reserves and the framework. He made a comment on our video from earlier this week in which he said, "I'm not sure the Fed will be able to use Fedwire to see when reserves are in fact getting scarce." And he responded with this chart talking about the estimate from the Fed of ample reserves and how much ample reserves are needed. The interesting thing here is that this is an estimate of the Fed. This is an estimate from the Fed of where ample reserves are, but you don't really see a ton of data. Why is that? The reason is because the Fed doesn't really like to talk about how many reserves it truly needs in the system for two reasons, two very important reasons. Number one, the Fed doesn't like to talk about how many reserves are needed in the system because it has gone way above and beyond that number consistently for the past 15 years, except for one moment in time, September 2019, with the repo crisis. Other than that moment in time, which of course is not a single moment, but it happens over the course of the preceding days and weeks, so we can call it mid-2019. Besides mid-2019, the Fed has had way more reserves than it has considered what it considers to be ample. The second reason that the Fed doesn't like to talk a lot about the exact level of where it envisions ample reserves to be is because the Fed has absolutely no idea. And that, in that way, we can expect the Fed to increase the quantity of reserves in the system to keep them ample because they don't know when it's scarce. They don't know the level at which it becomes scarce. So if you don't know how, if you don't know at what point reserves become scarce, would you keep a small amount of reserves or way more than what you might estimate to be? It's the latter. Now, let's bring it home. What does that really mean? It means that any sign of reserve scarcity in the system. And I'll give you one more note here on reserves before I complete the thought. Reserves are not used to lend money. We don't have reserve requirements in that a bank needs 10% reserves to then go on and lend money. U.S. banks need reserves to allow for intra-bank payments from bank to bank onshore. Reserves allow for banks to settle between themselves using Fedwire. That's why we need reserves. And if we need reserves for that functioning, it means that the Fed must make sure that reserves don't fall below the level that allows for the proper functioning of Fedwire. And so that is why we need reserves. It's not for lending, right? It's not that reserves are inert and we can't buy anything with them. That's true. Banks can't buy anything with reserves, and they can't lend them to people. They can lend them to their fellow bank. They don't really use that market anymore. But reserves are important. So the reason why all of this is so important is because if it is our understanding that the Fed will have to, at some point, increase the amount of reserves because of some reserve scarcity issue, which, by the way, we saw in 2019, we also most likely saw it in 2023 in the Silicon Valley Bank crisis, but it was stopped right away with these bailout facilities. So if we need more reserves, Michael Howe's chart here is showing you that the fitted line of the quantity of reserves to expect from the system is an exponential trend. And that is really the most bullish thing about real assets. It's that the size of the balance sheets of central banks must expand in the future if you account for the fact that they need ample reserves and they don't know how many reserves ample is. They're just going to create. And in that creation process, it does what? Does it spur on inflation when a central bank creates money? No, not by itself. What it does, though, is it boosts asset prices. It boosts financial assets, which then over time do contribute to inflation in the economy. But the first order effect is higher financial asset prices because the banking system expands in size. And the amount of collateral that can be used in the system expands in size as the Fed removes treasuries from the system, puts them onto its balance sheet, and then gets replaced by new treasuries that are issued. And yes, that does depend on continued deficit financing, but that is what we saw earlier in this video. It's a bipartisan path over the last several decades and on into the future. It won't stop. So the quantity of treasuries will increase, the size of the Fed's balance sheet will increase, reserve quantity will increase, financial assets will be supported. And that is the bullish case for Bitcoin over any time horizon as long as the policymakers represent the same behavior. So catch us on our research letter, which is free, thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. Please subscribe to this channel so that you can continue to see our videos as they come out, and we'll catch you guys next time. The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by River. River is a Bitcoin-only exchange, and we think it is the best place for you guys to get allocated if you have made that decision to purchase Bitcoin. So go check them out at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 in Bitcoin for free when you purchase.